We've got Pat Mundus and Richard Sanchez here, and they're going to talk about the wildlife refuges and those islands off of the coast of St. Petersburg that are so important. Okay. And Pat, why don't you start off by telling us the organization that you're with and the islands that we're dealing with.
Okay, great. First of all, thanks for having us. Appreciate it. I'm with the Friends of the Tampa Bay National Wildlife Refuges. That's quite a mouthful, but we work with U.S. Fish and Wildlife to promote their mission on their National Wildlife Refuge. A lot of people don't know there are three National Wildlife Refuges in Tampa Bay. We're very lucky to have those. Egmont Key, Passage Key, and the Pinellas National Wildlife Refuge. A little bit about the background. There are 570 National Wildlife Refuges across the nation. It's a pretty amazing system, really. You won't find another one like it in the world. It's right up there with our national park system. We work closely with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. We do outreach. We do advocacy, education, and refuge assistance. We go out and help them do physical labor. So we also do bird surveys and whatever they really need. A lot of our work's on Egmont Key, fantastic place, as Richard will be able to tell you here. And we're a member-based group. We have about 300 members who do quite a few different volunteer activities. So that's just a little bit of background on us.
All right, fantastic. And you're here with Richard Sanchez, who is was the president of the Egmont Key Alliance, which was a similar organization and dealt with that one island. Yeah, Richard, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me here. I'm not the president of the Alliance anymore. I've handed that off to someone else. And but yes, I was president for 15 years, and I was on the island for 17 years. And so while I was out there doing those things, I started delving into the history of the island, which goes back to really to the 1500s, to the English and Spanish explorers, and continued on to the Florida changing hands several times between the British and the English, finally becoming United States territory and then eventually a state. And so over those years, many, many people came out there and had some effect on the island or did something there. We had lighthouse keepers. We had Seminoles that were interned there during the Seminole War. During the Civil War, it was a base for the Union Navy to go after blockade runners, but also a place for Unionists to live, as well as enslaved people that were brought away from the Confederacy. And during the Spanish-American War, it became a quarantine site for the soldiers coming back. They had to be quarantined for yellow fever. So for a very short time, there was a quarantine site on the island. And then after that, we went into the Fort Dade era, where they built the fort. And that lasted until 1922, before it was shut down. So it'd be hard to tell the story of Egmont Key in just 10 or 15 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
I decided to write a book on it.
What's it called?
It's called Egmont Key, Stories from Eyewitnesses to History.
Great.
So when I was doing this, I had to figure out how I was going to present all this information. And so I decided what I would do is a series of personality profiles of all these different people. You know, who were they? Where did they come from? What brought them to Egmont Key? What did they do? And then what happened to them afterwards? And if there was any legacy. So I was very fortunate to find a few people that have not really told their story. One of them was the story of Congressman Sam Gibbons, who has done more than anybody in modern times to preserve not just Egmont Key, but Passage Key, Mullet Key, Calades, Honeymoon, and Anklode. All those islands were preserved because of him and his work. And I found the very first president of the Egmont Key Alliance, that goes back to 1991. She was living up in Dade City, and she had all kinds of records and things from when they did the big cleanup in 1988. That cleanup was when it became a state park. There was, over the span of about 3 days, they had 5,000 volunteers come out, both military and civilian.
Oh, wow.
And they took off 70 tons of trash that had accumulated over the years.
Whoa.
And cleaned it up. And that was the beginning of restoring that island and making it into a state park and eventually to the refuge.
Is that a similar thing that happens to all those islands out there, Pat? I mean, yeah, do people go out there where they're not supposed to be there and they have a party and they leave their stuff there? And
Yeah, that does happen, but it's not super common. I mean, the island is patrolled by Florida Park Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. For the most part, people that visit the north half of the island, which is open to the public, south half is closed. For the most part, people, as usual, behave, you know, they behave fine and follow the rules. Occasionally, there's an incident, and occasionally, you need to tell people you can't be in this area.
Which island was that?
Egmont Key.
Egmont, okay.
The Pinellas Islands are mangrove islands, so people don't really try to walk around on mangrove islands very much. And Passage Key is interesting. In the, say, 1910, Passage Key was 60 acres. It had a game warden's house on it. It had a freshwater pond. And Passage Key's story is the story of hurricanes. So last year's hurricane took Passage Key down to really nothing, and now it's about a 50-foot-long sandbar. So it's already starting to grow back. Mm. It's a very dynamic place, and the birds love it when it gets a little bigger.
What is the support you're getting from the state and the federal government out there at Egmont?
You mean after the hurricane support?
Just in general. Yeah, I mean, it's a national wildlife refuge also, right, on Egmont.
It's a complicated affair out there. The island is a national wildlife refuge, and Florida Park Service basically manages recreation there, although they don't own any part of the island. So that's sort of a mutual agreement between the two parties. We had a full-time ranger living on that island for years and years, Tom Watson. He was, of course, his place was pretty much destroyed in the last hurricane season. So we hope to get Florida Park Service to go out there on a daily basis and get that island opened fairly soon here. So
he worked for the Park Service, right? Florida Park Service.
Tom works for the Florida Park Service. The other interesting thing is Egmont Key is actually in Hillsborough County. It's kind of related to the shipping channel. And, of course, the Tampa Bay Pilots Association have been out there for 100 years, or about 100 years, let me put it that way. Their compound was virtually destroyed, so their future there is kind of up in the air right now.
Do you find that these keys catch the flow of the Humboldt Current trash that is circulating into the pathways?
What we see is most of the trash coming up on the east side of the island, meaning it's coming from the mainland. It's what I always say to people: if you're going to pick up trash, pick it up on the mainland before it gets in the water.
For sure, yes.
Yeah. What kind of person throws their trash out into the Gulf of Mexico?
Oh, gosh.
I really think a lot of it is accidental. But there are people that do, for sure, yeah.
And you'll notice I said Gulf of Mexico.
Yes,
and it
I
is.
Did notice that.
And it is.
Yes. Yeah, I think we'll have a hard time changing that habit.
Right, and I think if someone wants to cause enormous cost to the taxpayers, okay, the person that's recommending this isn't digging into his own pocket and taking out the millions of dollars that it's going to take to change that name from Gulf of Mexico to Gulf of America in all the school books, all the calendars, everywhere that it is. It's a ridiculous thing to do, and I hope Floridians, especially the west coast of Florida, all the way up to the Panhandle, all the way around to Mexico itself, just protests like hell against it. Leave it alone. That's the name of it. Ever since, way before man was even in that area, you know. So, what do you think, Richard?
Well, I think it was okay as the Gulf of Mexico, and it just seems to me to be an unnecessary step and just kind of poking a stick in somebody's eye just to try to change this thing.
Yeah.
Mexico likes it the way it is.
Well, it is interesting if you just think about it, you know, just as, you know, one agency having to change all those names. Yeah. It's a pretty significant amount of work for not much action, really. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of that. A lot of that in the government right now from somebody that's not dipping their hand in their pocket.
Yeah.
And the amazing cost of everything that's going on right now. It's
hopefully
incredible.
This too shall pass.
No? So we're working right now to get the island ready for the summer nesting season. Egmont Key is a very important beach nesting bird site. And we've had up to 30,000 pairs of nesting birds out there. So it can
what
be
kind of
just
birds?
Fantastic. Laughing gulls, a couple species of terns, black skimmers, which everybody loves, least terns. There are about 9 nesting species out there.
What about pelicans, brown pelicans?
Yes, you get some brown pelicans in the mangroves. We get white ibis. It's not a huge pelican nesting island. I feel like when they're a little late, they go out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, about the other keys.
Yes, and the Pinellas Wildlife Refuge, there are 2 very solid nesting islands, Jackass and Little Bird. Those are off near Tierra Verde. And those have been solid nesting for 10 or 15 years.
Wow, because the brown pelican endangered all over the world at one time. And and I've mentioned this several times, but Ralph Heath with the Seabird Sanctuary had a lot to do with repopulating. He at his own expense, flew hundreds of pelicans out to the Mediterranean and other places that are in the mullet latitudes.
Yeah.
Can you discuss about the mullet latitudes and how those keys fit into that?
Mullet Key and...
Yeah, the places where mullet live in the latitudes, which basically is the state of Florida, right?
Yeah, pelicans were on the edge and... you know, places like Seaside Seabird Sanctuary, shout out to them. It's
yes.
a fantastic group that, to this day, rescues and rehabilitates a lot of seabirds, yeah.
What do you guys do to get the keys ready for the nesting season? Is it like trash cleanup or...?
Well, this year trash cleanup is sort of exceptional, so there'll be a contractor cleanup this year. That's not quite as critical as getting... signage posted so that you can come by and just tell people, hey, you really shouldn't be, you know, at that spot. The biggest trouble for nesting birds are the 3 P's. We say predators. There can occasionally be a raccoon on Egmont Key, for example, people and pets, actually. Mm-hmm. A loose dog can basically devastate a nesting colony in about 15 minutes.
Wow.
And they will just go away and look for somewhere else, and you know, they're not emotional about it. They just go and start somewhere else. So.
And are people generally respectful of the signage that y'all put out? Like,
yes, yeah. People are generally respectful. If you're out there, you know, there can be 500 boats out at Egmont Key, even more on a Saturday. You may find 3 or 4 people that try to land in protected area. And most of those people, it's just a conversation. You know, you shouldn't really be here. Fine. And they move on. So.
If somebody wants to see Egmont Key and those keys, what's the best way?
Well, most people come out by private boat. Hubbard's Marina runs a ferry from Egmont Key. The island is closed right now, but we hope it'll open soon, as soon as we can have the ability to get staff out to monitor recreation. We lost the dock and virtually all the buildings. Well, virtually all the utility buildings. The lighthouse and the buildings around the lighthouse are fine. The guardhouse, there's a small museum out there that we open with volunteers on the weekends. That did fine also. But we did a lot of work out of the pilot's compound, and that was a virtual loss. So it was a total loss, really.
One of the interesting things that Richard told me about the other day that I didn't know about, and it's another example of how government works, and that is the Sam Gibbons situation. Sam Gibbons was a very famous and strong Florida congressman, and he took it upon himself, and he tell the story about how they went out there and how they preserved all those islands.
Well, it was actually started by his son Clifford Gibbons, who was working up in Washington, and he had a chance meeting with Rogers Morton, who was the Secretary of Interior at that time. And he arranged a meeting between Sam Gibbons, his father who was a congressman, and Rogers Morton to talk about these islands that were in danger of being overwhelmed by developers. That was his main concern. The developers were very active in trying to get to these barrier islands.
What were they doing, the developers?
Building condos and seawalls and bridges. So like Honeymoon Island's a good example of one where they got started. And so he got Rogers Morton to come down here, and Sam, Clifford, and the secretary got in a helicopter at MacDill, and they flew over these islands leaning out the door, and Sam would point out to an island, say, we need to save this one, and you'd say, okay, wildlife refuge. They flew over Passage Key, Egmont Key, Mullet Key, Honeymoon Island, Caladese Island, and Anklo Key. And had all those reserved for under federal authority to preserve those.
Every one of them they picked out of the helicopter.
Just pointed to it.
At the point of Rogers, of Sam Gibbons.
There was a plan afoot by the developers to build a bridge from the north end of Anna Maria Island to Egmont Key, which would have meant they would have put a seawall up and all that sort of thing. But that plan didn't get anywhere because they stepped in way before anything got going. Cliff told me a story that when his father was trying to put all these agreements together, it was between the Coast Guard, U.S. Fish,
you know, just as, you know, one agency having to change all those names. Yeah. It's a pretty significant amount of work for not much action, really. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of that. A lot of that in the government right now from somebody that's not dipping their hand in their pocket.
Yeah.
And the amazing cost of everything that's going on right now. It's
hopefully
incredible.
This too shall pass.
No? So we're working right now to get the island ready for the summer nesting season. Egmont Key is a very important beach nesting bird site. And we've had up to 30,000 pairs of nesting birds out there. So it can
what
be
kind of
just
birds?
Fantastic. Laughing gulls, a couple species of terns, black skimmers, which everybody loves, least terns. There are about 9 nesting species out there.
What about pelicans, brown pelicans?
Yes, you get some brown pelicans in the mangroves. We get white ibis. It's not a huge pelican nesting island. I feel like when they're a little late, they go out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, about the other keys.
And the Pinellas Wildlife Refuge, there are 2 very solid nesting islands, Jackass and Little Bird. Those are off near Tierra Verde. And those have been solid nesting for 10 or 15 years.
Wow, because the brown pelican endangered all over the world at one time. And and I've mentioned this several times, but Ralph Heath with the Seabird Sanctuary had a lot to do with repopulating. He at his own expense, flew hundreds of pelicans out to the Mediterranean and other places that are in the mullet latitudes.
Yeah.
Can you discuss about the mullet latitudes and how those keys fit into that?
Mullet Key and...
Yeah, the places where mullet live in the latitudes, which basically is the state of Florida, right?
Yeah, pelicans were on the edge and... you know, places like Seaside Seabird Sanctuary, shout out to them. It's
yes.
a fantastic group that, to this day, rescues and rehabilitates a lot of seabirds, yeah.
What do you guys do to get the keys ready for the nesting season? Is it like trash cleanup or...?
Well, this year trash cleanup is sort of exceptional, so there'll be a contractor cleanup this year. That's not quite as critical as getting... signage posted so that you can come by and just tell people, hey, you really shouldn't be, you know, at that spot. The biggest trouble for nesting birds are the 3 P's. We say predators. There can occasionally be a raccoon on Egmont Key, for example. People and pets, actually. Mm. A loose dog can basically devastate a nesting colony in about 15 minutes.
Wow.
And they will just go away and look for somewhere else, and, you know, they're not emotional about it. They just go and start somewhere else. So.
And are people generally respectful of the signage that y'all put out? Like,
yes, yeah. People are generally respectful. If you're out there, you know, there can be 500 boats out at Egmont Key, even more, on a Saturday. You may find three or four people that try to land in the protected area. And most of those people, it's just a conversation. You know, you shouldn't really be here. Fine. And they move on. So.
If somebody wants to see Egmont Key and those keys, what's the best way?
Well, most people come out by private boat. Hubbard's Marina runs a ferry from Egmont Key. The island is closed right now, but we hope it'll open as soon as we can have the ability to get staff out to monitor recreation. We lost the dock and virtually all the buildings. Well, virtually all the utility buildings. The lighthouse and the buildings around the lighthouse are fine. The guardhouse, there's a small museum out there that we open with volunteers on the weekends. That did fine also. But we did a lot of work out of the pilot's compound, and that was a virtual loss. So it was a total loss, really.
One of the interesting things that Richard told me about the other day that I didn't know about, and it's another example of how government works, and that is the Sam Gibbons situation. Sam Gibbons was a very famous and strong Florida congressman, and he took it upon himself, and he tell the story about how they went out there and how they preserved all those islands.
Well, it was actually started by his son Clifford Gibbons, who was working up in Washington, and he had a chance meeting with Rogers Morton, who was the Secretary of Interior at that time. And he arranged a meeting between Sam Gibbons, his father who was a congressman, and Rogers Morton to talk about these islands that were in danger of being overwhelmed by developers. That was his main concern. The developers were very active in trying to get to these barrier islands.
What were they doing, the developers?
Building condos and seawalls and bridges. So like Honeymoon Island's a good example of one where they got started. And so he got Rogers Morton to come down here, and Sam, Clifford, and the secretary got in a helicopter at MacDill, and they flew over these islands leaning out the door, and Sam would point out to an island, say, we need to save this one, and you'd say, okay, wildlife refuge. They flew over Passage Key, Egmont Key, Mullet Key, Honeymoon Island, Caladese Island, and Anklo Key, and had all those reserved for under federal authority to preserve those.
Every one of them they picked out of the helicopter.
Just pointed to it.
At the point of Rogers, of Sam Gibbons.
There was a plan afoot by the developers to build a bridge from the north end of Anna Maria Island to Egmont Key, which would have meant they would have put a seawall up and all that sort of thing. But that plan didn't get anywhere because they stepped in way before anything got going. Cliff told me a story that when his father was trying to put all these agreements together, it was between the Coast Guard, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and the Florida Park Service, and I don't know who all else got involved, but the idea was to create a set of interlocking and overlapping agreements that was so complicated, nobody could ever figure out how it all worked, and they couldn't undo it.
Good.
That's great.
He succeeded beyond his wildest dreams, because it was several years, as he pointed out, it was several years before I had a good understanding of things, but it's worked. I mean, he used what he had it available to make sure that it was protected from development.
Right time, right place.
Yeah.
See, that look was when Reagan was in? I mean, who was the president at that time?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. It was 1985.
Reagan. Yeah.
It's amazing how that one trip was so vitally important to that whole part of the Gulf of Mexico.
Absolutely.
On the side of that where Florida is.
It was prescient.
There's a lot of places in this country that got run over and got overdeveloped, and there's nothing you can do about it now, you know.
And I do want to say, and sometimes we forget, but it's important to, you know, keep telling our representatives at state and federal level that these places are important to us. Sometimes it doesn't take anything more than that, but we really need to keep it out there because, you know, as a nation, we care about our public lands, our national parks, wildlife refuges, but sometimes that gets lost in the shuffle. And mm-hmm. In Tampa Bay, I mean, these places are important to us.
Do you have anything else to say as we wind this up, Richard?
Well, I did want to mention something about the sea turtles, the loggerhead sea turtles that really haven't talked about. When I first started going out there, we had about maybe 50 nests a year. And the last time I had numbers, it was up to 150.
Oh, right.
And so the sea turtle program has been very successful. And a lot of people don't realize that when a sea turtle is hatched, he heads for the water, and he won't come back to the island for 30 years. The females come back 30 years after they leave, and they come back to the place that they were hatched from. And nobody knows really for sure how they managed to do that, but it's only one out of about, 1,000? One out of 1,000 survived from being hatched to coming back to nest again.
Is that from the Archie Carr scientific research that he did with sea turtles? Really? Yeah.
It was very difficult to do because the lifespan life cycle of a sea turtle was more than the career of a biologist. So it was kind of hard to get that information until GPS came along and they were able to track. And they go for thousands of miles around to the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. And so they get into long line fishing and nets and pollution and predators. I mean, some of them don't even make it off the beach before a predator will get them before they get into the water. So it really is. It's been a very successful program. And, of course, you know, it's possible if erosion isn't or we don't maintain this island that the hatchlings from this year could go to sea and come back and Egmont Key wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
So that lifespan. So it's very important. It's kind of one of the last places where sea turtles can nest and you don't have to worry about lighting and traffic cars and things like that.
Egmont's had 3 or 4 really good years in a row, about 125 a year. And for the Gulf Coast, that's great. On the east coast of Florida, you get thousands and thousands, but over here we get fewer. So we're really happy to see that.
Fantastic. I want to thank you guys for showing up today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
This is a lot of great information, and a lot of it I didn't even know, and I'm sure people that are listening are appreciating it. And get that book. Name the title again.
Okay. It's called Egmont Key, Stories from Eyewitnesses to History. And the best place to get it is to go to my website at floridahistory.shop.
All right.
And that'll take you right to it. It'll be quicker than Amazon, and I'll get it right out to you within a few days.
All right.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for Pat and
thank you very
Richard
much
for
having
coming
us.
Down. Great,
yeah,
great presentation.
Yes.
Well, all right, Tim.
You're listening to the Florida Folk Show on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM, WMTBLP, St. Petersburg, where local music lives. Support for the Florida Folk Show comes from the Will McLean Foundation. The foundation produces the annual Will McLean Music Festival, featuring all Florida artists. They also produce monthly concerts and award annual college scholarships. The Will McLean Foundation also operates the Florida Sand Music Ranch.